All right, welcome to episode 81. So our guest is Robert Deaton, big time TV producer. I mean, he's done so much. I don't even know what to call you. What do you call yourself? What do you do for a living?
I am in the entertainment business.
That's what you say?
I guess so.
Most like, notably.
Because I do so many different things.
Yeah, that's why I was like, what do I even call Robert? So, because I want to talk about a lot of stuff, but like, you produce the CMAs, the CMA Country Christmas, the Billboard Awards, the CMA, the big show outside, the CMA
festival.
You've done like tons of music videos.
I did The Passion with Tyler Perry.
You did that?
I did that, yeah.
That was in the last 5 years.
That was the year before last.
Yeah, that's recent.
Yeah, that was fun. It was hard, but it was fun.
That's interesting to me because when I was growing up in Arkansas, like I went to watch the Passion play.
Yeah.
And it was in Northwest Arkansas. I don't know if they still have it anymore, but it was such a revered thing. Like every year, it was our youth group. We would go up, and it was a big deal to watch the Passion play. And people would travel from all over the world to this one tiny place in Arkansas to watch this Passion play. And I remember whenever you guys, and it wasn't exactly the same, but whenever you're taking on something like that with Tyler Perry that has kind of a religious tone, feel, that's what it's about. Like there's some weird pressure to that, right?
Yeah, you know, the most pressure I ever had because you don't want to let Jesus down.
Did it rain or something crazy?
Like it rained every day during rehearsal. When we rehearsed Trish Yearwood, who played Mary, it was like we were in a hurricane. It was completely raining. We never did one rehearsal. All of it was in the rain until we did the show.
Now, let me ask you for real. Like, if it's raining every day and you're doing something with Jesus,
mm-hmm.
Do you a little bit go, all right, Jesus is talking to me right now?
No, the whole project. It was a lot of pressure. But you know what? Tyler Perry? The man can throw down a prayer. He is he's incredible. It was like when we get in the room and he'd throw down a prayer. It's like
you get into what room?
Like just going into his dressing room, or just getting ready for the show. Boy, he would pray and he would. It was like I wish I had a script. I wish I had it written down somewhere where I could go back and look at it. He was awesome. He's awesome.
So as a producer, what does a producer do? Because I think a lot of people see it on TV pop up and go, producer, you know, Robert Deaton. They don't really know what that entails. So, like, if you were to go talk to, explain it like I'm five, what does a producer do?
So, every creative decision goes through me. So, set design, lighting design, individual performances, who gets on the show, what are they going to sing, every single aspect of the show goes through me. So now I have a great team, of course. I got great people, lighting designers, set designer. I think that, you know, a producer has to have good taste. You know, I think that's really important. So yeah, everything goes through me, every creative decision.
I'm going to veer around a bit. You talk about creative decisions and at times you take risks as a producer. And I don't know if this is a risk or not, but I was watching the CMA festival special.
Yeah.
And to me, I thought Brothers Osborne stole the show.
Killed it.
Now, I'm biased because I love those guys and I'm friends with those guys.
Yeah.
But I really thought they stole the show. And there was a point where there was a really long John guitar solo.
Yes.
On network TV in prime time.
7 minutes.
And I'm thinking to myself, as it's happening, like, I love this and I enjoyed this, but that was a risk.
That was a risk.
And I think it paid off. But for you to put that, first of all, Brothers Osborne, who to the mainstream aren't so known yet.
Correct.
And a guitar solo for that long.
Right.
Like
sometimes I feel like you have to do it because it's great. You know, I answer to the ratings and I answer to ABC and in the CMA, but sometimes isn't the answer good enough that it's just great? And so it was great. And there was, you know, and I didn't know them. I met them the day of. That's when I met them, during rehearsal. And I'm in the truck and I'm looking and going, oh man, I'm going to have to cut this down. It's like, this is going on and on and on. And then you watched how it was genius how he created that guitar solo. that how the movements worked in it and how it progressed. And so we looked at it in the edit and I was like, God, we just got to do it. I was like, let's just put it in and see if ABC says anything.
That's such a big time commitment for such an out of the box thing.
It is.
Did you think they were going to come back and say, you need to cut
this? I did think they were going to cut it. I thought they would call back. Luckily, you know, there's music guys. You're a music guy, right? You get, you know, growing up, I was about TV and TV shows and music. That's all I was about. Just, you know, I would look on the back of the album covers, you know, who played on this record and who did that. And I just love music. And so luckily, there's a guy at ABC. He came over from Kimmel. He was the music booker.
I know him.
Scott Iger.
I know him really well. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a great guy.
Yeah, great guy.
And so Scott called me and said, I love the Brothers Osborne. And I was like, great. We're going to keep it all, right? And he's like, absolutely, keep it all.
So Scott was the guy that saw it and said, this is good. Let's keep it. It's like the perfect team.
It is.
Like, it's two music lovers.
ABC is in trouble. No, surely it is two music lovers. And again... I've booked things, again, just because it's the right thing to do, like Girl Crush. You know, when I first booked it, I booked it for the Billboard Awards. And it wasn't the hit now that everybody remembers in the award winning. And it was just one of those things, man. It's like, we should book this because it's great. And we did.
Talk to me a second. We'll just stay on the CMA Awards for a minute. There's a lot, but...
We're talking about a risk. Can I? The open... Last year's CMA Awards was a risk.
Last year's? You mean this?
The 50th.
Oh, in Dallas?
No. The 50th for me here in Nashville. The 50th anniversary of the CMA Awards.
That's right. Because all the acts.
Because all the acts.
It was a legendary... That's right, because you had a lot of legends.
That was
And some
risk.
Of them were really older.
Older. Right.
Like... Because what it was, I'm remembering now, what it was is they all played part of a song, and at the beginning of the CMAs, it was like this...
One song after another.
Of all different greats.
Yes.
But some of them were really old.
Well, you know...
It struggled.
It was a risk, and I will tell you, I had calls from people going, wow, you are really... Wow. Just managers going, by the way, we're for you. We want you to do this. And when you get Charlie Daniels or Roy Acuff, Charlie Daniels or Roy Clark, and they're thanking you for being there, it's like, you don't need to thank me. You've earned being here. But it was a risk, but it was also, the rehearsal was tough, man. It was like, it was a nightmare.
But you had people you could fall back on. Like, I remember again, I'm just going from memory here, but like Paisley,
Carrie Underwood and Alabama and Roy Clark. And
they were in it. So it was almost like a balancing act where you kind of had to stack someone who maybe was older and couldn't move as well as they used to against someone who could, just in case.
That's correct. It was funny. We were, like I said, we never did get one full rehearsal. I mean, the first time you saw it was on the air. And so it was just like, you know, because we were bouncing back and forth between bands, between Brad's band and Carrie's band. And it was so important to me, though. But so it was a train wreck nightmare, the rehearsal. So I'm walking across the stage. I got my head down and I hear a voice. Looked better on paper, didn't it? And it was Vince Gill. I'm like, it'll be fine. And Vince is like, yeah, it'll be good. It'll be good.
Who was it that was struggling in rehearsal where you're like, man,
you know what it was? It wasn't necessarily artists struggling. It was the number of artists and the time, you know, just the time period of going from one to the next. Because, you know,
like transitions.
It was the transitions, and it wasn't any one particular artist. We had a hard time with, of all things, we had a hard time with Mountain Music.
Alabama. Yeah.
Of all things, just musically. You know, we were playing the wrong chord or something, and only Randy could hear it. And it was like, so that took a minute, but it was just the sheer number of artists back and forth. But I will tell you, it came off. I've looked at it 500 times It's like the proudest thing I've ever done.
So once you do that and it comes off early on in a TV show, and that's the hardest thing, were you able to kind of go a little bit, even though it was early in the show?
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, the first reaction is, we can be men in here, right? But I cried. It was like,
none of us are men in here. We're all men.
No, we're not. Okay, good.
No. Okay, there's nothing manly about this room.
Me either. Yeah. So I cried. It was when I knew, by the time we got to Alan, I knew we were through it, and I knew it was great. And then, because you know what, growing up, I grew up in Wilmington, North Carolina, and my father worked at a television station. He had a Friday night country music show. I was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. And he had and I was on the show. I was a square dancer on the show. So what he would do is book all the country music Grand Ole Opry stars that were coming through. Buck Owens, Ray Pilla, Jack Green, Jenny Seeley. So I was always around this as a kid. So I felt pressure even in that. I was like, I got to get this right. Not for me, but for them and for the history and what we're trying to accomplish. So, yeah, I cried at the end of it. And I did feel that way. I felt like we're going to be, because I knew what I had coming up too. I knew I had George Strait and Alan Jackson. I knew I had this great duet with Garth and Trisha. You know, I had Garth singing Don't Close Your Eyes by Keith Whitley. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. So I knew I had those things that you, kind of like the old Al Jolson thing, you ain't seen nothing yet. I felt that way. But it was a lot of pressure.
I'm going to talk about Express Pros for 1 second. So for just one corporate job, only 4 to 6 people will get an interview for every 250 resumes received. Like 4 to 6 people, that's it. And that's for every 250 like resumes from people trying to get the job. Those are not good odds if you're trying to get the job, if you're just uploading your resume or just giving your resume. The fact is you need a real person advocating for a real employer that has a real job. And that's where Express Employment Professionals comes in. If you're listening right now, Express is your local resource to help you get a new job. Express has more than 18,000 jobs available weekly. That's 18,000 jobs that need to be filled right now. So find your nearest office at expresspros.com, and Express never charges a job seeker to find employment. Your locally owned Express office can connect you with available jobs in your community. On expresspros.com, find jobs in all kinds of things like, let's see, accounting, customer service, manufacturing, distribution, information technology, you name it. All you have to do is go by the nearest Express office today and speak with hiring professionals connected to the available jobs in your community. Visit expresspros.com today. You can find the location nearest you. Go check it out. Expresspros.com. Okay, so staying with CMAs, let's talk about Brad and Carrie for a second, because they've been doing it successfully for a long time.
This will be their 10th year.
And it's always the joke, hey, this is the last year we're going to do it. That's Brad's like, as long as they'll have us, I mean, 10 years, and they're still funny.
Yeah.
But when you started 10 years ago, like, was that, who put them together?
I put them together.
Okay.
I did, yes. The first year, this will be my 11th year. So the first year, we didn't have a host. Yeah, most people don't remember that. There was no host the first year that I was named the executive producer. We had multiple different people from TV, from movies, and then artists. I felt like that there wasn't a through line. You know, there wasn't that, I like a host. You know, I like the host is taking you through the evening. And so I picked Brad and Carrie. And
did you pick them separately, or did you know that there was a dynamic between the two that had already existed?
I did not know that there was no. I had worked with Carrie I had her do a couple of intros for the festival and work with, and she just like completely brightens and lightens up and on on television. It's incredible when that light goes on. It's like crazy. And then I just felt like Brad was modern day. The artist, Roger Miller. It's like clever, and songs were funny, but he could also do Whiskey Lullaby at the same time. And he was like, you know, and also, I felt like Carrie was very contemporary, and, you know, I did not know that they would connect the way they did.
Did they connect year one?
No. Well, they did. We did. No. I say no. We just didn't. If you look back at the first year, there's like two jokes in the whole monologue. It's like literally 4.5 minutes. I mean, really, we were just hoping they would not fall off the stage. You know, it was that kind of thing. Everything that we did, it grew. Everything grew. We started figuring out who they were on stage, what their relationship was on stage. Because it's like playing characters, you know. For example, we decided she's going to be like more like a sister to him. There's not going to be any humor where she's trying to put him down.
What's the writing room like the week of whenever you're going in? Because the monologue
is 9 to 10 minutes long.
It's long and it's very important because, again, whatever you put at the front of a show sets the tone for a whole show.
It does.
And so that monologue's very, very important. Yeah. So what's a writing room like the week of?
And
Brad and Carrie involved?
Yeah, to back up just a little bit, they're always involved, by the way. So we've already, it's September. Our first meeting we had was in August. That's insane to have artists involved that early. We meet every day and there's a lot of changes. We never get really locked in until maybe the day of. It is constant. We are in the room together. It's myself, Brad and Carrie, Ann and Bill, their management, and David Wild, our writer, and myself. And it is...
One outside writer?
There's one, just one.
What, for the most... Really?
Yeah, it's us.
That's really strong then.
Like, yeah. It's really us. It's crazy. We feel like that, you know, and again, just like anything else, we can get in rhythm. It's like the first couple of times we meet, I mean, we come up with a few things that are good, but we're still not yet right in rhythm. You know, it's, you develop that, you know, when you practice free throws in basketball, it becomes muscle memory. We have to get that back, you know, and we do. And it's because we're in a room together and we can sit in a room and we can say anything. We can throw out anything. There's nothing off limits.
You're comfortable being vulnerable, which creates the best. You can create the best when you're vulnerable. And if you're in a room where you trust everyone, it seems like you guys have that.
We do have. Yeah. In fact, we have made people leave the room that have come in before. Like we've had people, like I remember the year... We had, we went up, remember when Carrie did she did the musical, The Sound of Music? So those first meetings had to happen in New York.
Because she was up there. Right. That.
So we went up there and had a writer's meeting and Randy Goodman, head of the label, came into the room. And that was great. We were all glad to see him.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
But I told Randy,
it wasn't the environment for him to be.
Well, you've got to leave.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point in time, I was, and I, by the way, I've known Randy since I was 15 years old. So so I said, Randy, it's so good to see you, but you got to go. You have to leave the room. And he's like laughing. And I'm like, no, really. you really have to leave. And because we have to be in an environment that we can say anything and make a fool out of ourselves or take a joke too far. There's a lot of jokes that we would never put on the air because they go too far, but you've got to go there to be able to get to the real joke or to whatever it is we're trying to say. So
at what point in that, of the, let's say 10 years with it coming up, did you realize, okay, we have something here that can maybe kind of be a staple of the show. Like these two together, this is a thing, at least for a bit.
I think that the third year, the first year, again, we're just all of us. This is my second year, too. So it's like we're all babies together, just trying to figure it out. First year, 4.5 minutes, two jokes. Second year, what we hit upon that I felt is very important still today is the musical parodies. When Brad came up with that, hey, I got this idea, I was like, nobody else can do that. That's something we can own. Nobody else can do that like that, where they pick up a guitar, do a parody, play like Brad, sing like Brad and Carrie. Nobody can do that. So, but it was the third year where we hit the stride. The third year where it was the third year we opened with Hank Williams Jr. and the Barbie Dolls with Tim and Faith. That was the year where we're like, okay, now we are off to the races. We know exactly what we're doing. We know what we're trying to achieve. And, you know, the Barbie Dolls, for example, that happened. I read it in the paper that they were coming out with Barbie Dolls. Called my assistant immediately. I don't know what we're going to do with them, but order two pairs of Barbie Dolls. Then at the same time, Carrie was texting Brad, have you seen that that Tim and Faith have Barbie Dolls? We've got to do something. So by the time we got into the room, it was just in rhythm. It was like, well, how are we going to get into it? I think we should, you know, and I said, I think we should, this is your fourth year, give each other gifts, presents. And then Brad's like, oh, and I can act like a two-year-old. Oh, Tim McGraw Barbie. And so it just rolled like that. So we made something that's like a one-beat joke where it's just a visual into this whole, you know, two minutes of monologue or 2 minutes of content. So that, you know, and then it was like, that was the year that, you know, Hank Williams, and I did all the openings for Monday Night Football. So for 7 years, I worked with Hank. So we came up with this whole bit, this whole parody of Hank. And I said in the writer's room, hey, what if we had Hank come out? Brad didn't know Hank, neither did Carrie. And it was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? You think we can get him? And I'm like, I'll just call him.
I've only worked with him for the past. Yeah. So when you talk about the jokes, has there been a joke or two that actually went out where you're like, oh, that was not received well? Like it went over the line, even though listen, as a stand-up comic, there are jokes that I have one that I only have tried once because, you know, I work clean.
Yeah.
So I don't curse at all in my act. And so I did. Yes. And so I have a joke and I only did it once and I kind of was like, ooh. And it was about, I mean, I can tell the joke here, right? I mean, we're good. You're not going to
offend. Of course not.
So the joke is, there was this dude that was whacking off in a movie theater watching the Emoji Movie. Right. Uh-huh. And everyone was upset about this, you know, like disgusted by it. And the joke was, I wasn't disgusted, but I was wondering which emoji he was whacking it over. And it was, then I started to, you know, was it the dancing girl or was it the poop emoji? It was that whole thing.
Right, right.
But when you start talking about whacking off, your act kind of goes from PG-13-ish to a little more than that. So I did it once. I was like, ooh, it was funny. And I'm dark. I have a dark sense of humor, but there's certain things I can put on stage and some things I don't feel comfortable putting out there. And after I did it, I was like, you know, I probably should have held off on the whacking off joke.
Right.
Like, it didn't feel like it until I did it, and I was like, whacking off went a little bit too far. And so, has there been a joke where it went out and you were like, ooh, maybe that was a bit too far?
Yeah. It's hard for me because I'm not out in the audience. So, all I can react off of is what I hear, you know, on television. Because also, by the way, I'm backstage right behind the stage. So there's so many things going on. I think that there's been some, you know, there's been things where I thought, oh, you know, I'm not sure.
Or maybe going after people. Did you ever think about that? Like maybe we shouldn't go after the situation?
Well, here's the thing that we try to do. We try, you know, we hope that we're not hurting anybody's feelings, that they are, that, for example, Blake is always a great sport. Tim and Faith, they're like, they love it. The first couple of years, I will tell you the truth. Well, especially 3, 4, 5, we had to stop doing the monologue and dress rehearsal because I would get back. We do the dress rehearsal the day of show. I'd get back to my office and there'd be 10 managers. You can't say that. You know, it's like, really? That's funny. You know, what? And they would want me to take it out of the opening monologue. And I'm like, I'm not doing it. You know, this is what we're doing. And so we stopped doing, we don't do a rehearsal anymore. The first time that Brad and Carrie do it on stage is the first time that they is you see it on network television. Now, I will tell you this, that so there have been a few things where things took off, like, for example, that we didn't intend, you know, for example, the year Kerry said the line, yeah, and I'm pretty sure that's why the Democrats lost the Senate. It was, you know, and we're like, really? That was a throwaway line. That right. was, you know, we weren't even thinking that that was even anything that anybody would even think about. And then there was, oh, Obamacare by morning, where it was like, we got all this the next day. Like, we can't believe you said this stuff about the president and blah, blah, blah. And we're like, No. We just were making fun of a slow website. We never, you know, so things like that that take on its own life, you know, it was, we're surprised sometimes how people interpret some of that thing, those things.
I always wonder, for example, the Blake and Randa thing was so big. It was such a big thing, and they have two different personalities, having gotten to know them. Blake will talk. Randa doesn't want to.
Right.
But it's almost like an elephant in the room.
Yeah.
How do you...
Well, you know how we did it. We didn't address it with Miranda. Exactly how you just described it was how we handled it. Because we knew there was no way. It would hurt Miranda's feelings, I feel like. And we wouldn't want to do that. I mean, it was just, you know, we kind of gave it to Blake a little bit, you know, but not much, you know, we just weren't going to make a big, that would have been wrong for us to do. You know, especially something that was, again, we're not there to hurt anybody's feelings, and that was not the right time or the place. This is the CMA Awards, and we feel like, you know, we're the Oscars of country music, and to do something that was, you know, obviously painful for both of them, just wouldn't have been the right thing to do.
But it's, and I'm fascinated with jokes because I'm a writer and a joke teller. So I think we could probably do 2 hours on just the philosophy of writing a monologue. But it was such the current event. And not even because it was good, but it's what everybody was talking about. And when you get up and you have to talk about what everybody's talking about, it kind of puts you guys in a bind. Because what if you say nothing?
Well, we talked about, if I remember correctly, we talked about the breakup in the room, you know. And everybody knows what we're talking about.
And
the misdirect is it was Kermit and Miss Piggy,
right?
You know, and then
you
and
said
then,
it,
right?
And everybody felt it was addressed without it being addressed.
Without it being addressed,
I bet you some butts puckered like crazy. I mean, holy cow!
Well, and here's the thing: we felt like it needed to be addressed, and we would. But and then what we did was there was a beat, you know. We showed Kermit and Miss Piggy out in the audience, and then the next beat was Brad. So, how's it going, Blake? You know, and we cut to Blake and he laughs. You know, and so, you know, again, that was a touchy situation
for everyone,
for everybody.
It was touchy for me, and I wasn't having to do the national TV show.
Yeah.
You know, I had both people. One of them wanted to come on the radio show and talk all about it, and one of them was like, I don't want anybody talking about it.
And the thing about it is they're both great artists, you know, and have been very important to the CMA Awards and to country music and what they've done, and individually what they've done. Just, you know, I just had Blake on the telethon last week, you know, for Hand in Hand, where we raised money. Raised what, $45 million. And then
when I left, it was only like 10. And I woke up the next morning, it was like 45.
right.
The next day, it was like 45.
It was crazy. And then, you know, Miranda has done so much with Mutt Nation. And it's like, you can't, you know what? That would have been another thing, as far as writing the joke. That would have been the easy way would have been to go through, you know, to do something off color, but we're more clever than that. I feel like we try to be clever and we try not to hurt anybody's feelings. So,
you know, to me last year, the crazy part was it was game 7 of the World Series versus the CMAs.
That was crazy.
First of all, as like I'm a diehard sports fan, I'm a diehard Cubs fan, and at when the Cubs went down 3-1, you had to be feeling pretty good that it wasn't going to go Game 7, right? Like you had to be feeling pretty good,
correct?
Because that's worst case scenario yeah. that they come back yeah. and win 3 in a row.
Yeah.
So Game 6, you got to be like, come on. Come on, Indians! Like were you the biggest Indian fan ever? Game 6?
Oh, absolutely! I was pulling for the Cubs when it started.
When it started, yes, yeah, but then game it
was
six. Like
no, then I had to switch. So yeah. No, that was it. Was you know what? It was demoralizing actually at first when we realized that they were going to Game 7. It was terrible. But then you know what? What am I going to do? I mean, I stayed that way for like 30 minutes and it was like, I still got a show to do. And you know what? It's still going to live in the universe forever. And so people are going to be, so it was just like, you know what? We're just going to do the best we can. We still retain 97% of our, 97% of our audience.
Which is amazing considering that the Cubs hadn't won since 1908. And even the less than casual sports fan wanted to flip over and see.
Exactly.
That's why it was such a good number for you guys, because that was a huge victory.
Well, exactly. And just think of what our number would have been had it. I mean, we retained 97% of our audience. So what would that number have been if we hadn't have been against Game 7? So
I wonder, do they come to you? Because I remember the next day looking at it. And frankly, I was like, man, everybody. Because I did the red carpet for television. And my girlfriend played with Carrie. Lindsay L. played guitar for Carrie that night. And so I was torn. I was like, oh. So I watched. Then I had to, because I'm a diehard Cubs fan. And so then I came back, and then I flipped, and I did it all back and forth. And I was like, I wonder, the next day I woke up, I was like, I wonder what the rating is for your award show. And I was like, wow. I honestly was a little blown away that it was that high, not because the show wasn't good, because I thought the show was fantastic, but that was a once-in-a-lifetime sporting event, and it still did so well. So does ABC go, hey, man, great freaking job.
Oh, yes.
Like, even... Like they had to, right?
They did, yes, they did. They were ecstatic.
Like what a victory! Even though, like you said, you retained almost all the year before. But who would have thought you go up against the one time in baseball in our whole, the biggest baseball game of our entire life?
Yeah,
you're up against.
Yes, it's crazy.
But congratulations, because
thanks.
That's a win.
It is a win, and I was very proud of the show. But you know, but you know what? Again, the rating is important. It is the important thing. But the other thing is for our artist and our genre and any show that I'm doing, it is where it also lives in the universe. Think about the Justin Timberlake, Chris Stapleton moment. I mean, that following week it had been viewed by over 20 million people. That's in addition to our audience that's watching it live on television. So people are, it's like late night television. You know, people are finding these things, or finding the performances, or finding the monologue, or finding all this content in different places. It's not the same thing as it was five years ago.
I have you to thank for a big part of my career, that some things that I get to do as far as breaking artists. So I'll set you up with the story, and then you'll see where you come into play here. Man, it's been... Now I don't even know the timeline, but there was this artist that lived in town. He was a songwriter, and I kept bringing him in, and nobody knew who he was. I kept bringing him in, and he didn't have a record out or anything. I called him. The first time I ever called him, I called him at home. He was in the shower, and he's like, hey, let me call you back. I'm wet. I'm in the shower. I'm like, okay, cool. So he came up. Nobody knew who he was. Blew the roof off. Second time I came up, I started getting in trouble for bringing him in, because my bosses, who don't, some of them don't listen to the show because they're national. They're in New York or LA, and they're like, hey, people are reporting back that Bobby, who has 5 million listeners, so why is he playing this unknown artist on the show that doesn't have any hits? So my direct boss said, hey, what are you playing this to? I was like, trust me, he's really good. And then thank you, Robert Deaton, because you put Stapleton on with Justin Timberlake. And I think it's the biggest moment in the last 5 years of the CMA. I think that's the biggest moment that, and I don't know how you did, because I want to ask what went into that decision. But you made me look brilliant. Like you putting that and creating that, that's what made Stapleton what he is to people. He already was awesome.
Yes.
People just hadn't
Incredible.
Seen it yet.
Incredible.
He would come to my studio, I'd be blown away. I'd be like, how is this guy not something? But you're the one who put him on. And because of you, I get to break artists like crazy now. Like, my company's like, you know what? I quit. You just do you. And because you put those two together, they finally gave me the, you go ahead. We'll leave you alone. So I got to know. First of all, thank you very much for that. Secondly, how did that come together?
Well, I had been already in touch with Justin for several years and trying to figure out a way to get him on the show. We were close one year. We thought we were going to do a remote from, I think it was in New Jersey. And then, you know what? His manager called and said, listen, he definitely wants to do the CMA Awards one day, but when he does them, he wants to do them in the room. He wants to be there. I'm like, I totally get it. And you know what? He should be here because this is a great room. You know, it's like if you're an artist and you haven't done the CMA Awards, it's like I have people out of genre all the time going, I had the best time. It was awesome. I loved the people. There's writers and,
right.
You know, it was just great. So I found out through Chris Stapleton's management that they were friends. And so I reached out and Chris reached out, but we both reached out.
When, like, you got the, yeah, he'll do it.
It was on the phone with Justin.
Really?
Yeah. So this is what happened. So the questions are from Justin. Well, how much time do we have? And I said, as much as you want. You know, it's like, because, well, first of all, let me back up this one bit. My son, you know, he was I guess, junior in high school at the time. Like, I mean, I knew Chris Stapleton's record backwards and forwards, like every note, because my son was such a huge fan from the day the record came out. So I am constantly hearing this record.
The Traveler.
Right, Traveler. And it's a great record. And so I knew everything about the record. And then he comes out with all these nominations. I will tell you, that was a surprise.
He's so beloved in the industry that a lot of people in Nashville were like, this is the underdog guy who's so good that's unknown. We're voting for him.
Correct. Yeah.
So he gets all the nominations and you go, okay.
All right. So then we reach out to Chris. So then we have a telephone call. It's myself, Chris Stapleton, Justin Timberlake, and management. So the questions are, again, how much time do we have? It's like, how much do you want? You can have whatever you want. This is going to be great. And then the other question was, where are we going to be in the show? And I said, you know, where are you, you know, for most people don't know, but the highest rated show, the highest rated points of a television show are crossing the hours. So I was like, let's cross the first hour. I said, are those the right answers? And Justin started laughing, and Chris and Justin's like, yeah, those are the right answers.
So then you have to decide what to do. Now, who gets to, because it was Drink You Away, and it was the David Allen Coe Stapleton cover.
Yes.
Help me out, Mike D. What's that? How do you guys decide on the song?
Tennessee Whiskey.
Tennessee Whiskey. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So
they decided on that.
So they come to you and say, hey, this is what we'd like to do.
This is what we'd like to do.
And you say?
I say, of course.
You got it.
Of course. You know, this is what we want to do. But I tell you what was interesting, though, because, as far as the look is concerned, you know, a lot of artists like Justin Timberlake, they bring in, you know, tons of people from Los Angeles or wherever. And we got on the phone and we're like, this is what the three of us kind of decided what we thought it ought to look like. And then we just did it.
Did you feel like it was special the first time they did it together on stage?
I did. I thought it was really great.
Okay. There's a lot of,
but I did not.
There's a few greats a night.
Yes. I thought it was great.
Okay.
I did not know that. So we do the rehearsal and it's great. Okay. It's obviously going to be a moment. Justin came up to me at the producer's table and said, don't worry about it. I'll really bring it up tonight. I was like at 50%. I was like, oh, okay, great, thanks. You know, I'm like, I'm already on to the next rehearsal. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I mean, it was very polite of him to do that and very professional. But yeah, but they brought it up. Did they
you ever know it was a thing when it was happening live?
Yes, when it was live. Yes, I did know it was. You could feel, even backstage, you could feel the room changing. And then what we also started doing was seeing the reaction of every of the audience. I mean, you can.
For me, it was mind blown.
It was crazy.
My mind was blown. I was like, this is the greatest thing I've seen. This mix of all of it.
I just started telling the camera guys, start shooting the audience, you know, because that was also the story. Like, you, I mean, you cut to anybody, you cut to any artist, and you can. It was genuine, genuine love, genuine awe. You know, I think there was awe for Justin Timberlake and going, oh my gosh, it's Justin Timberlake. And I think there was love for Chris Stapleton.
And a holy crap. Like, how have we not known this guy until right now?
Right. Well, you know what? It's a perfect storm too, right? Because it's like, okay, so we made sure that we mentioned Chris Stapleton in the opening monologue. Because we felt like it was important. I didn't know he was going to win any awards. But we were like, Brad and I and Carrie were like, hey, we need to mention this guy. This is one of the greatest singers ever to be in the format. Let's make sure that he gets some notice. You know, so we thought, let's take care of that in the opening monologue. And we did. Brad says, you know, Chris Stapleton, one of the greatest singers that's ever been in the format. Well, then he wins. And wins and wins, and then the performance. It's like, and he was trending worldwide, you know, on Twitter, Chris Stapleton. It was like, who is Chris Stapleton?
And the wins would have been a big deal, but I don't know if you, in your heart, feel this way, but had you not created that scenario and that performance, the Chris Stapleton world that we live in now, where he's adored because he deserves to be adored, I don't think it would have happened.
Well, I don't. I can't say that. But
I'm saying it though. Like yeah. I'm saying, I think you created the environment, and it's all like for me. I've had people do it for me. I've had people that said, "Hey, I believe in you. I'm putting you here. I believe in you. I'm putting you here." Like I think that you putting Stapleton and creating that environment is what has allowed Traveler to be heard. It was made wonderfully. That product was going to be fantastic, regardless.
It was incredible.
There's so many things we don't get to hear though because we're not exposed to it.
Right.
Like you exposed Chris Stapleton to the freaking world.
Well, I will say I am really proud of that moment. I was in Los Angeles at the Soho House, the restaurant. So it was there were like 12 people at the table. I was the only person and that had anything to do with country music. And they started talking about great performances and award shows. History, not the CMA awards, all award shows. So they asked me mine. One of mine is Prince and Beyonce opening the Grammys. I was there. Incredible. And it was funny because four of the people were like, my favorite moment is the Chris Stapleton, Justin Timberlake. They didn't even know that I had produced it. And I was like, I raised my hand. That's mine.
You talk about other performances that, because you produced the Billboard Awards too, and the Florida Georgia Line John Legend performance.
Yeah,
when they crossed over, tell me how that because I thought that was awesome too. I love the fact that Legend played Holy.
Yeah,
and I know John a bit, and to go to how did that come apart, and how receptive was he to doing that?
Well, John was really receptive because we're good friends. I don't know if you remember this, but I did a one season of a show called Duets.
It
was on ABC. It was John Legend, Robin Thicke, Jennifer Nettles, and Kelly Clarkson. So John and I became really good friends. And since we did Duets, I called John. I was like, hey, come do the Christmas show. I know you don't have any Christmas music, but you know, come in and do the CMA Country Christmas show. So we did, and we've worked together again on the Billboard Awards, and we stay in contact. And you know, literally, he won the Oscar I texted him and he responded like 10 minutes later. I was like, that's cool. You know, it's like he just won an Oscar and he's, I thought maybe in a couple of days I might hear from him, but he is one of the most unique, talented, intellectual. He's just a really good human being. And I had, and he loves country music, by the way. He's friends with Faith and Tim. I knew that he had been in Nashville writing before. And so a guy named Mark Schimmel and I came up with this idea, and I just called John, and he got out of, he actually changed a date to come and be a part of it. So when they do the rehearsal, I had written out, you know, different parts, like the arrangement, you know, I'd like, so it was like when we got there and we were doing the rehearsal, they were each doing their own song. And it was like, well, that doesn't work. It's like, why are we doing this then? If, you know, so I asked John, I said, John, I need, you know, this doesn't work unless you sing part of Holy. And John's like, well, I'm all right with it if the guys are. So then the guys were around the corner waiting for another rehearsal around the other side of the set. So this was so great. And this is what's great about working with musicians and great people. And so I went over to the Florida Georgia Line guys and I was like, hey guys, this doesn't work unless John sings part of Holy. And they looked at me and they were like, oh my God, do you think he would? And I'm like, no, he will. I just talked to him. And they're like, really? He could sing the whole thing if he wanted to. They were like, oh my gosh, you're kidding me. John Legend's going to sing our song. And I'm like, no, he doesn't need to sing the whole thing, but he's just got to be able, that way the performance works. So they were like thrilled that he would even consider doing it. And so I thought it really worked. I thought I was really proud of that moment.
And Chrissy hosted, right?
She hosted the year before.
Was it the year before?
Mm-hmm.
So I know them.
And I love her too, by the way.
So how I know them is one of my best friends is Andy Roddick. His wife's Brooklyn Decker. And Brooklyn and Chrissy are really tight.
Okay.
So I would know them through hanging out all together. And Chrissy's awesome.
Yes, she's awesome.
And I knew Chrissy before she became Chrissy Teigen. You know, she was still, don't get me wrong, she was still an SI swimsuit model. So it was like nothing to go, but before she was like the super influencer and became super famous.
Well, yeah. I didn't know, you know, this is sometimes my head's in a ground, but when I met her, I didn't know any of that. She was just John's girlfriend. We would go over, like, he would have like cookouts and stuff while we were doing duets. And so we would go over and have food and hang out. And I didn't know. And that's how we became friends. And I was so thrilled when she did the billboards with us, because it was just, you know, it was great just to be with her. And then she got pregnant and couldn't do the next year. So,
oh, is that why?
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, that's why she couldn't do it.
So your background in television is, I mean, man, it's long. Like, since you've been having memories, you've had memories of television.
Yes.
And music.
Yes.
Like they're both your thing.
Right.
Which works perfectly with a lot of what you do. But even like, I guess before we even go back to your childhood, like you've done a lot of music videos.
Yeah, 400 maybe.
Like that, a lot of music videos. Like
I don't do them anymore though.
But looking back, like you do some flats. You did some flats.
I would say the majority of all the Rascal Flatts music videos. I did Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy by Big and Rich, Independence Day by Martina, Believe by Brooks
Independence
and Dunn.
Day. Let's hold on that one for a second.
Yeah.
Like that was a big video.
That was a big one.
That video, like the video was vivid to me. Like the song was a big deal for me listening to the radio. Like Independence Day, that was a big deal for me. But I remember the video.
Yes.
At a time when videos were starting to not be as video-y, if that makes sense. Like videos were such a big deal. But Independence Day cut through at a time for me whenever I was kind of getting off the video thing. But I can still vividly see it when I can't think of any more videos around that time.
Yeah, it's interesting how that whole thing, you know, we made, that wasn't a number one record either, by the way. That was, I think.
Really?
Maybe top 10.
Wow.
Maybe. It's the first time and about the only time when I heard a record and I called the label and asked to do the video.
Oh, so you actually pursued the video?
I did.
Because you thought you were that passionate about it.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know Martina, and I had never worked with her. My business partner, George Flanagan, I didn't know. we didn't know Martina, and I called because I thought the song was just so powerful and something that needed to be said. So I wrote the idea. We sent it to Martina, talked to her on the phone for about an hour. She still couldn't decide whether we were doing it or not. So then she wanted to meet me. So I went down and we met with her for like an hour and a half. It was like therapy, crazy, talking about everything. And I said at the end of it, I was like, well, so, I mean, do I get the gig and do we get to do this? And she's like, yeah. So that's, so we did it. And, you know, it was at the time, you know, of the OJ, the whole OJ thing going on. And so there was a lot of, so what happened was, is like, we had released the video and there wasn't much, it was quiet actually at first. And then, USA Today did a story on it because of, domestic abuse and everything and reporting of what was going on in the world at the time. And then once they did that, did a story on it, front page story on it, then the song and then the video took off. So wow. It's too bad we had to have videos like that, but hopefully that it contributed to somebody.
What was
or help somebody somewhere, I hope.
Do you remember the last video you made before you stopped making music videos?
I do. I think I'm pretty sure it was Remind Me by Brad and Carrie.
Carrie and Brad, because
What happened was is I was really slowing that down and really getting out of it. And Brad and Carrie had done this song together, and they were like, you have to do this because you work with Brad and you work with me. So, you know, so it was like, that made sense to do. So here's a funny one. So we shoot that opening sequence of Carrie walking towards the camera, you know, and it's Carrie Underwood. She looks pretty good, right? Brad's looking at the camera's like, oh man, this is not going to be good for me. I'm like, no, nobody's going to pay attention to you. You're just gonna,
he could see already that yeah, she had stolen
first. The whole, yeah. Oh yeah. She had stolen. He's like, this is not going to be good for me. No, really. I started laughing. He's like, no, really. This is, and I'm like, yeah, right. As soon as you got Carrie Underwood in this video, nobody's paying attention to you, pal. So
as a kid, who did you look at on TV and go, man, that would be awesome. I could be like that.
You know, I always thought that it would be great to create these things.
So you were, even in your mind as a kid, you weren't the guy. Because for me, I look at David Letterman was my hero because he looked funny and I looked funny. And he said weird things and I was the weird kid.
Yeah.
So I saw him as me. You saw, wow, I want to make David Letterman happen. I want to be the guy.
Right, I did because I was always at a TV station.
Because you saw it.
When I was little. So I would see the director working and, you know, and it was funny because my dad was on air talent. He was, you know, but I just never, you know, I always like, I just like the movies I love. Like, for example, White Christmas. I got to watch that movie every year. And it's when I was little because it was behind the scenes. You know, I loved all that behind the scenes of the trunks and the clothes and the changing and, you know. Are you familiar with the movie?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love that, you know, all that stuff. So I, and then, you know, before my dad was at the TV station, it was a radio station. So he would bring home the 45s. And I loved my 45s. I loved the actual seeing the logos of the record labels and all the different labels, you know, that was my collection. He would bring home records or I would go, like, he'd do remotes, you know, and I was like five, six years old, and he would do remotes at, like, you know, a hardware store or whatever, you know, local thing. And it, you know, he would do an interview with someone like on the street or something, and I'd get, and he would point at me when to push the button to play the record.
So you were basically the producer engineer of the remote.
Exactly. So he'd point to me and I'd push the record. To me, that was magic. I love that. So I love everything about entertainment.
Did he want you to pursue a career in entertainment, knowing that entertainment sucks and is awesome, but sucks a lot more than it's awesome? Like, it takes a special breed to fail a lot. And that's what we have to do in order to succeed. Like, entertainment, you have to be okay with failing a lot. How did he approach you?
Well, you know, so honestly, that part of my life was young, you know, when I was around the TV station and all that. And then when I got into my teenage years, honestly, I didn't see him much. You know, he had started a band, and we're being honest and real here. So, you know, he was on the road and wasn't around, you know? And so there wasn't at that point much guidance, you know? So, you know, all the women in my life, my grandmother, my mom, that's why to this day, I love strong women, you know, like Martina McBride and Carrie Underwood. And so at the time, as a kid, you know, I was rushing to get out, you know, it was like school and high school. I think if I went back, I would rather maybe take a little bit more time and enjoy where I was, but I was ready to leave. I wanted to be in this business so bad, in film, television. But no, there wasn't that much, honestly, there wasn't that much guidance at a certain point. And it was pretty painful there, you know.
I spent a lot of time in therapy, I didn't have a dad at all growing up. And, you know, my mom had a lot of issues. But for me, you know, I was always chasing the, hey, you did a good job. Do you feel like...
Definitely.
That's absolutely a bit why... Because you wanted his approval. Absolutely. Because as you're saying those words, I'm like, I know that exact feeling. Like, I know exactly what you're saying right now, because that's how I felt my whole life.
Absolutely. I think definitely want approval. And I think because that absence of that, you know, growing up and not having him. Like, here's the thing. Being so close and so connected, and then like the door shut. And it was like, then not. It was like, I mean, we did everything together. Horseback riding. I was part of the TV show. I was always around the TV station. And then all of a sudden, 11 years old, nothing. You know? And so, I think you're right. I mean, I think I am definitely that way. But I think it serves me in a really good way. You know, I think that, you know, there's nothing more important to me into getting the performance right, making sure that they're happy, making sure that the artist and the music is right. So I think there is that wanting to make people happy. That's part of it. But you know what? I think that's what partly makes me successful. I might've been different.
I know with me, like, it's always been that's where I search for love. And this is going, we're just getting deep here. Like, my therapist would be like, this is where you go out to search for love. Is you're going to a crowd, you're going to do stand up, you're going to do, you to play, you get on the radio and tell your stories, you do your television show, and this is your search for love because you never got it as a kid. My grandma, you know, raised me, adopted me. You know, my mom was there on and off, you know, and she died in her 40s. I never had a dad until, so it was just like, that was my place at the same time, I was trying to piss everybody off by being successful. Like, I'll show you. You don't want to, no support for me. I'll just go make it myself, and I'll show you exactly what you've kind of missed out on. But my approval was always trying to find love from, it still is. What am I talking about? Was. Like, that's still why I'm psychotic. Yeah. Is that I'm trying to find love right. Yeah. From this other place because I never got. But what I've learned is nobody's whole. Like, I haven't met one person that when you really sit down and talk to them, they're like, oh, I'm just good. Yeah. I used to think that I was just like, a victim. I just think, man, in my life. But I think, as you said, it's made me stronger. And I did a TED talk where I was like, you know, for a long time in my life, I was like, it really sucks how I grew up. I was the food stamp kid. I was a kid that had really bad teeth. I was the poor kid. But that's what made me stronger.
Right.
Like, I use that now. And like, I'm a fighter and I'm a grinder because of all of that time where I'm conditioned now to, I'm going to work harder than anybody. And this is how I naturally work.
Correct.
Because I had to.
Yeah.
And then,
I agree 100%. You know, it's something that you said about, I'll show you. I've had that every single day of my life. It's like, there's no doubt about it. I'm going to show you. Here's the thing I tell people at in classes or, you know, there's a lot of talented people out there that are sleeping late. You know, it's like that. There, you got to get out. You got to get, you know, every day I'm ready to compete. And that's, but I, you know, and it, that's what you got to do to be successful. But it is a part of, I'll show you. It's a part, it's really funny. It's I'll show you, and it's part, you know, serving people or wanting to do good by people and wanting to people to go, oh, you did a good job, you know? And it is that I would say those years, those formative years definitely plays into, I will tell you the truth. 4 years ago, if we'd have done this interview 3 years ago, I would have never mentioned that to you. I would have never said anything.
What was the breakthrough point in your life where you're like, I feel like I can talk about this? Because I've had those.
Yeah.
Like, where was it? Where was it in your life that you hit where you're like, I'm now okay with that?
I think that, I think it's a conversation that I was married once before, went through a divorce. And that was painful. It was also another situation where I don't think I, or at least I perceived, never accepted by her father. So that was another, I'll show you, you know. But I think it was my, you know, I got remarried, and I was dating who is now my wife, and we were in a conversation, and she said, hold on a second. Wait a minute. You know, you're not like everybody else, right? And I'm like, what? She's like, you're not like everybody else. You're different. You're special. And she has made me believe that. So I think she's the reason why I can tell you that today, or tell that story, or go back into something in my past that was painful.
And now you have a son that plays the crap out of an instrument.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, he beats those things.
He does.
So
he's a heck of a drummer.
So now you have a son, and he's drumming like he's fantastic.
Yeah, he's really a good drummer.
Like, what do you tell him? Because it's a cycle. Like, you're able to see, the cool thing is you can see the cycle, so you can break the cycle. That's the hardest thing about a cycle, is if you don't see it, you can't break it.
I told him, he asked me when he was 11 years old, do you think I could be a professional drummer? And, you know, and he's still, you know, struggling. He's had two development deals. It's hard, you know? I said, you know what? Then go for it. Don't worry about a backup. Don't do a backup. Don't have a backup plan.
Because you have a backup plan, you'll use it.
You'll use it. Absolutely.
That's how
I've had other parents. They literally think I'm crazy. Just think I'm crazy.
Well, you are. But it takes crazy to be great. Like, it takes crazy to be great.
That's exactly right.
I'll go speak, and, you know, the same thing. I'll go talk to these classes, or I'll do a TED Talk, or I'll do it. And it's like, hey, plan A is what your dream is. And plan B is, go back to plan A. Otherwise, you're just going to go and work at your cousin's accounting place because it's going to be the easier thing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to be crazy.
You have to be crazy. It's, the thing about it is, if you could be happy doing something else, then you should do it. You know, but if I would not be happy. You know, this is what I want to do. I don't have any hobbies, by the way. This is it. You know, I don't go play golf. I don't, you know. You know what? I love seeing my son play drums. I loved seeing my daughter's in film and television, and I love seeing what she's doing. And then my son James was an athlete. I love being and seeing what they're doing and being involved in their life. And my wife is constant. You know, there's, when I'm with her, there's no place I'd rather be. You know, because she's like the most interesting person that I know. And the kindest. And so, but other than that, this is what I want to be doing. I want to be producing, directing. I want to do another film. I love my shows. I love the CMA Awards. I love the history. This is what I want to be doing.
You ever see Step Brothers with,
I love that.
I feel like, do we just become best friends? That's kind of what it felt like there. I think we just became best friends. Well, listen, we spent an hour talking. It just flies by, but I feel like I went to a master class a little bit. Dang.
I appreciate it.
All the kids out there listening, there you go. Call them at home. Give me your cell phone number. Okay, so I'll say, because this thing lives forever, and the CMAs are coming up in November. People will be listening to this for a year or 2 years. But they're coming in November. Right now, what is the date for today?
It is the 19th.
Of September?
Mm-hmm.
Of September. So when you watch this year, Robert will be producing everything that's going on, and every decision that he's made. Because people wonder, if they don't know, like they just, that word producer, I don't think most people know what that means. And I don't say that in a negative way. I didn't until I got involved into the business in different ways. But that's the guy or the girl, just the person who's controlling all. That's you. You're the creator. The creator. Man, I can't wait to see what you got in store this year. And I love the CMA special. I thought the Brothers Osborne moment was such a cool moment. Like, I was watching it in a hotel because I was on the road. And I don't even go do my set until like 9:30 because I have a couple opening acts. And I remember watching the Brothers Osborne and going, man, next time I see Robert, I got to tell him how great that I thought that was. Like it felt like a risky move that really paid off.
Well, Karen Fairchild texted me. And
she
said,
did?
Yeah, she said, thank you for Brothers Osborne. That's all she said. And I totally get it.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Man. I appreciate it.
Robert Deaton, and I don't know if we promote. You want to sell a product or anything? All right, episode 81 of the Bobbycast. Thank you. We'll see you next time.